House of Men.
Terrible Tommy knows, and we're here at the bunker in Warsaw, Indiana, 46581.
There is a fifth dimension beyond that which is known to man. It is a dimension as vast as space and as timeless as infinity. It is the middle ground between light and shadow, between science and superstition, and it lies between the pit of man's fears and the summit of his knowledge. This is the dimension of imagination. It is an area which we call the Twilight Zone.
And believe me, we're living right in the middle of the Twilight Zone. Not at the edges, right in the middle. Terrible Tommy here, in the bunker, right here in North Central Indiana, and right next to Terrible Tommy's Terrible Tavern and Steakhouse and Filling Station, where we only sell Ethel and Regular, and that's right next to our Weapons of Mass Destruction used equipment yard, where we're painting them up, plugging up the holes and everything out in the barn during the winter. And in April, we're going to open up again. You come down here and bring an 18-wheeler and buy the biggest damn weapon of mass destruction you can carry home. Yeah, and then get ready to do whatever. I want to thank our Chinese communist friends for helping me get that stuff back over here from the Middle East in their Chinese junks. They got some real heavy-duty engines in those junks, boy. Don't take those junks lightly. Yeah. They get in through the Caribbean and then up into the Mississippi River. Then they come on up to the Ohio River and on up, and then they get off on the Wabash River and come right on up here within a mile of my place. And a bunch of happy coolies. We treat them to a few drinks over at the tavern. Yeah. They get drunk as hell and then navigate back down to Mississippi. I'm going to take a big chance of destroying my reputation here and telling you sort of a colorful joke. I got a lot of laughs out of it around. There's a gal down to the lake. She comes down there fishing every day. And the boys started noticing she fishes on out of the left side on one day of her boat and on the right side out of her boat on the next day. And this goes on and on. Well, finally, the boys got up enough nerve, because she's a pretty tough old gal. They said, we see you come down here fishing every day, but you throw your line out on the left side and then on the right side. What's that all about? And she says, well, it's like this, boys. Now, if you got kids, get them away from the speaker. Well, I wake up in the morning, look over my husband, and if his penis is on the right side of his leg, I fish out of the right side that day. If the penis is out of the left side that day, I fish out of the left side. And they said, well, what happens if it's straight up and down? She said, that day we don't go fishing. Ha ha! You know, one of these goody two shoes right wingers would never tell you a joke like that, even though they want to and they know the joke, but they want to pretend they're good Christians and love the baby Jesus. But we don't have to pretend anything here in the bunker. We can do what the hell we want to do. I told you I did that two-hour show with White American Radio show the other day on Saturday. And the She-Wolf has edited it and set it up. And so the next couple of days we're going to play these two shows. One tomorrow and one the next day. And I want to tell you, if I don't piss somebody off with those shows, I don't know what I'm going to do. I try awfully hard to offend people. But try as I might, I don't seem to get them offended that much. So I don't know. Well, anyhow, they'll be played. And boy, I lay it out. I lay it out there. Well, let's see. My gal and I went to the movies yesterday. We usually take some time off on Sunday afternoon and do something like that and usually go to the movies. I like movies. I've always loved movies. I'm a movie habituary or something. I don't know what you call that. movie addict. I went to see London's Fallen, man. Had that actor, what was his name? Butler. Gerald Butler. He's an Irish, Scotch-Irish guy. And he's been making movies over here for a while. He's in his 40s. Damn good actor. I think he's a really good actor. Well, that movie was really something. Special effects were fantastic. But I'm not going to spoil the plot for you. Or I'm going to give you a little bit, just enough to wet your whistle. That at the beginning of the movie, they got a drone strike going in on an obvious Arab place where they got an Arab wedding going on. And it comes a drone in, blows the whole damn thing up. And the next scene, you're in London. And all of a sudden, they get a message from this Muslim Arab guy. He's a powerful guy. And they try to make him look real bad that he's a super arms dealer and all that instead of being just a Muslim or religious nationalist, you know. But anyhow, he's going to kick their ass. And evidently, he'd been planning this for a long time. And so, you know, at least they started out the film by giving, showing some reasoning behind why he's going to kick their ass. Because they come over there with their drones and kill their people, their family, killed his daughter. And so he says it's time to take the war to the West. Yeah. Sort of a little bit like the 9/11, only a hell of a lot bigger than the 9/11. So anyhow, that goes down, and they're going to have all the presidents and the leaders of the world show up there in London for the funeral of the prime minister who's died. And so they get them all in there, and then all hell breaks loose. So anyhow, it's worthwhile to see this movie because it's sort of sending a message in a way that, God damn it, you've been bombing the shit out of us and killing us for all this time and invading us and occupying us, and I think it's time to kick your ass, and they do. Okay. Anyhow, but Butler's, Butler, I hate to say this because he'd probably be all pissed off if he heard me say it, but if you've ever seen Soupy Sales, a comedian from back in the 70s, used to have a kids show, but it was also adult really at the same time. I was a big fan of Soupy Sales. And he, in the face, looks just like Soupy Sales. I couldn't hardly keep from laughing. And I wonder if that haunts him as an actor, that he looks like Soupy. In fact, until I researched who he was and where he came from, I was almost positive he was the love child of Soupy Sales. So anyhow, that's the way it looked. Well, more and more articles are coming out on the possibility that Scalia, the Supreme Court Justice, was murdered, as I postulated early on, right after it happened. Always follow the money, and if there's something really big going down and somebody dies, it's very likely murder. And but I doubt whether they'll ever prove it, just like all these other assassinations. That leads me to I sit around and think, you know, that's one of my problems. I sit around and think about who stands to gain all the time from all this. Who stands to gain over this Trump thing wiping out the Republican Party? What's going on there? And why would David Duke come out and endorse him, knowing it would hurt him and maybe cost him the election? But maybe that's the way it was planned, because all hell broke loose after Duke said he was going to support him. And then this yahoo from Massachusetts, who ran for president the last time around, for him to attack Trump is almost like it was a setup because that would help Trump. So we got on one side, Duke hurting Trump, or trying to hurt him, or at least hurting him without knowing, but he would know. And the other side, trying to directly hurt him. There's something big behind all this. Something big. Now, I know a few things. I know that David Duke was CIA in his college years for a while. He told me directly he was hired by the CIA to train Laotian army officers in English. No big deal. But still, he's on the list of the CIA. Some of the people he's dealt with, one is a major pornographer who ran his offices there in Metairie, Louisiana, to the tune of about $1,500 a month, which nobody else had ever worked for. Duke ever made that kind of money. That's interesting. Why a man would risk his name and reputation by doing that. But even after that information got mostly out, the right wing and the people who support Duke kept supporting him. And now recently there's another big time, I think he's a drug dealer, it was a couple of weeks ago, got arrested. It was one of Duke's guys. And then Duke's down, had a gambling habit, and he's down there gambling on the Mississippi. Gambled away about $250,000. That was interesting. And then also he got caught up in the one thing. He got sent to prison for a while. That's interesting. He didn't do any hard time. It was easy time. Then he runs for office and gets into the legislature. Of course, like I told you, I ran his first campaign back in 76, I think it was, for state representative, which he lost. And then he's traveling around Eastern Europe all the time. What's that all about? Where is he going over there in Eastern Europe all the time? I think he had some contacts with the Ruskies. Who knows? Or maybe contacts with the ragheads. I don't know. Well, if you're running around over there, you got every opportunity to do it. What I'm trying to get to you is there's a lot of pieces to this puzzle, including one well-known doctor that committed suicide over one of Duke's operations. That never was brought out very much either. But anyhow, there's a lot of pieces to the puzzle. I don't know exactly how the pieces go together, but and then on the other side too, I don't know, but there's something bigger going on here. The dismantling of the Republican Party. It's not just Trump. There's more behind this. A lot more behind this, boys and girls. So we just have to keep our eyes open and ears open and jot down every piece of information that we get and try at some point to bring all these pieces together into a mosaic, because there's something really rotten in Denmark out there. Yeah, I think it's great. Worse is better and chaos is even better. And why do they bring out old Duke every time as a whipping boy, the media, all the time? Never anybody else. Never anybody else. Is it because the ADL has got all the goods on Duke? They know all his pitfalls, everything he's screwed up with, all the people he's dealt with. The ADL someday will probably release it all. And we'll wait around and see. I may not be around, but you can wait around and see. See, the ADL doesn't release everything they've got. They just keep gathering tidbits over the years, put them in a file, and then when they need them, they bring them out, or they bring part of them out you know, part of the time. And if they really needed to go get somebody really, really, really big, they bring the whole file out just like J. Edgar Hoover did. But I'll tell you one thing, if you've been in the right wing like I used to have been all those years, we've been had. I'll guarantee you, they guided us right along the way they wanted us to go. But we're not doing that anymore. We're doing a different thing now. But believe me, all those years, fighting the Ruskies and the communists and all that crap and voting Republican and right wing, we had been had. We were being used. Incidentally, they're going on and on about this wonderful, saintly Mrs. Reagan. Yeah. Well, you got to go back a ways to find out a little information. See, Ronald Reagan used to be married to Jane Wyman, who was a very good person as far as I can dig up. Nice woman. And she loved Ronald very much. This Nancy, what's her name, came along and started fucking Reagan in the back room, and all of a sudden he leaves Jane Wyman and runs off with his Nancy. And she ran his life. From then on, she was running his life. And all the way up till during the presidency, having this official astrologer in the White House deciding on every move they made. So essentially, and that was Nancy Reagan's work there. It wasn't Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan was a follower. Anybody that knew him in Hollywood knew that. He was a follower, but he was good at taking orders from powerful people. And like my friends used to tell me that retired from Hollywood down to Fallbrook, California, we had a lot of Hollywood people down there. We'd sit around, have a few beers, and cameraman, sound man, all that kind of stuff. They'd laugh about Ronald Reagan. They'd say, the directors, you know, when you're making a movie and you're on a sound stage, you're supposed to stand on the X. They got X's around, and certain times of the shooting of the film, you got to stand on that X. Well, Reagan get it all screwed up, and he'd be on the wrong spot. And these Jew directors would scream at him and say, Reagan, you goddamn idiot, get on the damn X. And he'd dutifully trot right over there. That was his whole life. He was a Democrat early on. And the powers that be told him, now we want you to go over and be a Republican and be a conservative. And so he went over there and he played that game. The best roles he ever played was as president. His movies were lousy, except one movie Ronald Reagan made. It was about a bank robber. And that movie's around. It was a good movie. He played a bank robber. All the rest of the movies sucked. I'm not sure whether Jane Wyman's still alive, but I feel very bad for her because she really got the shaft by Ronald Reagan and Nancy. And I think she's probably dead by now, but probably a good thing, because she probably anguished for 30, 40 years over the shaft she got. She played in a movie, Johnny Belinda, I think. I forget exactly what the plot was. And I think Jane Wyman might have played a Joan of Arc film. I'm not sure about that. I may be mistaken. But she made a lot of good movies. You know, another thing that's a bunch of bullshit is this stuff about Hillary's emails. I don't give a shit. If all that stuff came out, you know, all that secret shit came out, it would help keep us away from screwing with other people. Yeah, that's what you want. You know, Snowden and the boys to release all that stuff. WikiLeaks, they're national heroes. They're my heroes. I wish we had dozens of those guys dumping all the so-called secret files on the market. Yep, I do. Even that transgendered guy, he's a hero too. You know, they gave him, what, 30 years or something? But he did a good thing. He did a good thing. I was... Look, most of that information is known already by the Russians and everybody else anyhow. And the more we get it out there, the more it blunts the Pentagon's plans to subjugate the whole world, the better. So, why do I give a shit? Hillary, you're a hero. You put all that shit on their personal computer. You didn't even know you were a hero. Put it all out there. Let's hear it all. If those foreign countries were hacking those emails, they're sitting around drinking vodka and laughing their ass off. I can imagine. You know, the American politicians must sound like a bunch of goddamn idiots when they're talking around and even putting out so-called secret shit. They're a bunch of clowns. They're an absolute bunch of clowns pretending to be professionals. They're a crazy bunch, you know. So I can see Putin over there listening to that shit, having some vodka, laughing his ass off. And they get all over this little shrimp over there in North Korea. Leave that guy alone. You know, this country gave him about everything he got as far as nuclear stuff. We gave it to him. You're going to go over there and fart around. They're having big maneuvers over there. You know, the Pentagon always does that. When anybody does something they don't like, they get a whole bunch of ships and a whole bunch of planes. Well, we'll show them. Well, they're not going to use it. They're not going to use them, but they're going to do it. Trouble is, sometimes things like that have a way of going wrong, like we've had things go wrong a lot of times in this country. So my advice is to leave them alone. You know, let's sort of use peace as a weapon. What do you think of that? Does that destroy my reputation? Peace can be a very good weapon. In other words, stay away out of people's business. Stay out of other people's fucking business, you idiots. Because every time you get into their business, they come after us. You know? And then you go big time after them, you know? It's let's face it. The United States government, ever since World War II and before, has been spreading violence and warfare all over the world. Always for a good cause. Always for a good cause. We want to spread peace and democracy. And if you don't like peace and democracy, we're going to bomb the shit out of you. Most legislators are crazy as a bed bug. But we got some real crazy ones here in Indiana. You know, recently they're trying to pass this bill into law to put cameras on all the cops on their shirt, which is a good idea. Not only does it protect the cop, but it protects the defendant. You know, did he do this? No, he didn't do that. We see it right here on the camera. Or the cop, did he brutalize somebody? No, he didn't brutalize somebody. That camera on the body is the best thing going if for honest people. But one of the cop groups came up with an argument they tried to put forth in the state capitol here in Indiana. They said, well, we can't have that because then all these guys would be jumping the cops just to get their pictures on the news. What? That's the craziest goddamn thing I've ever heard. That's the kind of politicians we got here in Indiana, you know. You know, that went along with the other law where they wanted to ban the cosmetologists from trimming beards and trimming mustaches. Only people that belong to the barbers union could do that. We got some crazy ones down here in Indianapolis, I'm telling you. Well, got to understand, you know, Indianapolis was where they had the first Communist International meet back in the day. At the same time, they had the national Ku Klux Klan meetings. So we're a mixed bag in this state. Oh, incidentally, the webmaster would like for volunteers that could go into our archives on the radio shows and pick out the different themes of the shows and give them to her. And then we'll be able to make somewhat of a catalog, I guess, or a directory for what the themes of the radio shows were. So that's going to be a little, it's not going to be an easy job, but we got volunteers out there. The webmaster would appreciate it. Okay. Back to Pessimist's Guide of History. I love it. 1836, the fall of the Alamo. In 1835, American settlers living in what later became the state of Texas rebelled against the Mexican government, then in control of the territory. And the reason they rebelled was not that they necessarily wanted to leave Mexico. But they were linked up politically with a state way down in southern or central Mexico. And so when it came to taxes and everything, the one the state closest to Mexico City was getting all the breaks, and the people up in Texas were getting shafted. And that's what led to this problem. Otherwise, Texas would probably never revolted from Mexico, or at least maybe not for a long time. Okay. Organizing a provincial government, the rebels named Sam Houston as leader of their small army, but began their fight for independence against the far superior Mexican army led by General Antonio Santana. The Alamo, a Franciscan mission at San Antonio, Texas, soon became the symbol of Americans' determination to win their independence. You see, they had a fight there at Béjar, and they whipped the Mexicans. And the, the leader or the general told the leader of the Mexicans, if you'll lay down your arms and not fight against us and promise not to come back, we'll let you go in peace. So they did, and the Mexican, who was the head of the Mexican forces, had just been defeated at Béjar, who was the brother-in-law of Santana. And after they got several miles south, headed back to Mexico City, Santana came up with about 7,000 men. And he forced his brother-in-law to turn all his troops around and go back to Texas. And that's what that was all about. You can't trust that shit. You get them on the run, you keep them on the run. Don't make no deals like that. Okay. Manned by a small force that included renowned frontiersman Jim Bowie. And, of course, Jim Bowie was married into the Mexican aristocracy and had a big ranch in Mexico. He was sort of fighting for his own property. And he came from a family of big cotton people back in, I think, Mississippi. I think it was cotton. It might have been some other crop, but his family were quite wealthy. But he was sort of the black sheep of the family. And, of course, Davy Crockett, you know, he'd been a congressman. And then he'd lost his Congress job. Of course, too, he married an Indian. He went back down and lived with the Indians after he got kicked out of Congress. So he wasn't exactly an Aryan warrior. And let's see. The Alamo was surrounded by Santana's 4,000-man army. I heard it was 7,000. On February 23rd, Major William Travis, in command of the Alamo, appealed to Sam Houston for reinforcements. but only a handful of volunteers managed to slip through the Mexican lines. On March 3rd, before the actual fighting for the Alamo began, Major Travis informed his tiny force, just over 180 men, that there would be no reinforcements, and offered them a chance to leave. Only one man took him up on the offer. And guess what? We believe he was a Jew. We know his name was Moses Rose. The Mexicans began their attack at night. He was probably the accountant. He was probably the accountant. Said, screw this, I'm getting out of here. The Mexicans began their attack at night on March 5th. Twice the Alamo defenders bravely turned back charges over the overwhelming Mexican force. But on March 6th, the Mexicans successfully stormed the Alamo's northern wall, which wasn't very high, boys, and within a few hours had killed all but five of the Alamo's defenders. Santana had paid a terrible price for the victory. However, he lost over 1,500 men and squandered 10 days' time in defeating the Alamo. That's why if you're going to go down, man, take them with you. Take as many of them with you as you can. Okay. Perhaps that was why he let his soldiers slaughter the last five Americans, and why he allowed the bodies of the dead to be mutilated and burned. The heroic stand of the doomed rebels was not destined to be forgotten, however. Confronting a large Mexican force at the Battle of San Jacinto in April 1836, Sam Houston rallied his troops with the now famous cry, "Remember the Alamo." The American victory in that battle secured the independence of Texas. The fate of the one man who left the Alamo is unknown. He probably in Israel. Well, anyhow, I think they should dwell more on the Battle of San Jacinto than the Battle of the Alamo, because Houston took his bedraggled army and kept retreating and retreating and retreating. He almost had a rebellion of his troops. They thought he was a chicken. But Houston was waiting to find the spot, the perfect spot, to challenge Santana. And he found this spot, San Jacinto, and he turned around and whipped Santana's ass. Santana tried to escape dressed as a woman. Believe that. Santana was a major figure in Mexico. He was a general of the armies, and then he'd been deported a couple of times. He came back, and it's quite a story. The life story of Santana is probably very, very interesting. I never read it. Well, one more here. 1836, a theater fire killed 700 in Russia. The Lehman Theater in St. Petersburg caught fire during a performance on December 30th. Hundreds of theatergoers were trapped in the blazing building. Wow. Those kind of things happened quite a bit in the old days. Buildings weren't nearly as fire retardant and protected as they are today. However, it still happens today, too. Well, that's it from the Pessimist's Guide to History for today. I'll be bringing you some more good news maybe tomorrow. In the movie The Alamo, there was a lot of scenes that were good, very good, but one that was very funny to me was Travis was the commander, and he was about a third the age of Davy Crockett. And Davy Crockett picked up a whiskey bottle and says, "Drink a whiskey?" to Travis. Travis says, "I don't drink." And Crockett says, "Never?" It was funny as hell. Well, I think if you knew for sure that you're going to die, and you're going to die pretty quick, I'd sure have a few drinks. I want to add something that I talked about earlier in the show about how things seem to be coming together for one reason or another. It's almost like the 100th monkey theory that if you haven't read, you should. Along with, I think it was Napoleon Hill who wrote about the mass mind. And then you've got Crowd Psychology by Gustave Le Bon. I think that there's a lot of things coming together, and there's this genetic memory and all this stuff, and I think we have the ability to communicate with more than one person. I think that if our thoughts are strong enough, I think somehow many people start getting the same thoughts at the same time. You know, look at when the automobile was invented. It was invented in almost the same time in all the countries, all the white countries. That's happened many times. We seem to have some kind of a genetic communication. Because many times I'll be talking about something, thinking about something, and I'll mention it to my gal. And then the next day I hear some politician or somebody saying the same exact words. I keep feeling like I say, somebody's tapping my radio show. Think about it. We have abilities we haven't even started to tap.
I picked up a little.
I picked up a little soundbite from a film, True Detective. You might have seen it, Matthew McConaughey. And the other one, I forgot his name. But anyhow, I thought this was pretty amusing, so I cut the clip out of the film to run it for you.
He's a saint.
And I forgot to tell you, this was these two detectives had gone to this tent revival meeting. They're looking for a guy. But the conversation between the two detectives is very interesting. One is agnostic, maybe atheist, but pretty logically speaking. The other one's sort of nominal Christian, but he's a rounder, he's a whoremonger, he's a drunk. So let's listen to this interplay between these two detectives as they're standing at the back of this crowd out of nowhere's land in a revival tent.
Where is
Nashville? Parish FD said the church burned down 4 months earlier. No prince put out an APB on Friends of Christ. A week later, they were in Franklin. Revival ministry, old time religion. You can imagine what Mr. Charisma thought of that.
Who do you think the average IQ that this group is, huh?
Can you see Texas up there on your high horse? What do you know about these people?
Just observation and deduction. See a propensity for obesity, poverty, again for fairy tales. Folks putting what few bucks they do have in the little wicker baskets being passed around. I think it's safe to say that nobody here's going to be splitting the atom, Marty.
You see that? Your fucking attitude. Not everybody wants to sit alone in an empty room beating off the murder manuals. Some folks enjoy community, the common good.
Yeah, but the common good's got to make up fairy tales, and it's not good for anybody.
Your sorrows came you to this place. They divide you from what your heart knows. And there are a lot of good hearts out there. I've looked out and I've seen a lot of good hearts out there. I see a lot of good out there.
I mean, can you imagine if people didn't believe what the things they get up to?
Exact same thing they do now. Just out in the open.
Bullshit. It'd be a fucking freak show of murder and debauchery, and you know it.
If the only thing keeping a person decent is the expectation of divine reward, then, brother, that person is a piece of shit. and I'd like to get as many of them out in the open as possible.
I guess your judgment is infallible, piece of shit wise.
You think that notebook is a stone tablet?
What's it say about life? You gotta get together. Tell yourself stories that violate every law of the universe. Just get through the goddamn day. What's that say about your reality, Marty?
When you get to talking like this, you sound panicked.
You think it's all a scam, huh?
Mm.
All them folks?
Mm-hmm.
They just wrong?
Oh, yeah. Been that way since one monkey looked at the sun and told the other monkey, he said, for you to give me your fucking share. People. So goddamn frail, they'd rather put a coin in a wishing well than buy dinner.
Jesus Christ, Jesus Christ, your arms open and closed. The echoes of my life can never contain to see the truth about you. You move the feather in the ash, you touch the leaf with its flame.
Transference of fear and self-loathing to an authoritarian vessel. It's catharsis. He absorbs their dread with his narrative. Because of this, he's effective in proportion to the amount of certainty he can project. Certain linguistic anthropologists think that religion is a language virus that rewrites pathways in the brain, dulls critical thinking.
Well, I don't use $10 words as much as you, but for a guy who sees no point in existence, you sure fret about it an awful lot. And you still sound panicked.
At least I'm not racing to a red light.
You know about Hillary getting all that money for those speeches? Well, of course you know what it was for. I mean, who's kidding who? I mean, who is kidding who? Well, here's a little article about that on a latest expose.
Exclusive. Hillary Clinton has judged that she can wait out public calls for her to release the transcripts of speeches to Goldman Sachs, which earned her $675,000 in 2013, since she expects to soon wrap up the Democratic presidential nomination, as Chelsea Gilmore describes. By Chelsea Gilmore. One of Bernie Sanders' standard attack lines against Hillary Clinton has been to call attention to the hundreds of thousands of dollars in paid speaking fees and donations that Clinton has received from Wall Street during her career, including $675,000 for three paid speeches to Goldman Sachs, at $225,000 a pop, after she left the State Department in 2013. Former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton confronts Senator Bernie Sanders in Democratic presidential debate on January 17, 2016. Former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton confronts Senator Bernie Sanders in Democratic presidential debate on January 17, 2016. Sanders has even taken to keeping track of how long it's been since Clinton vowed to release the transcripts but hasn't. Clinton now claims that she is being held to a different standard than other candidates and will release the speech transcripts only when others do the same, if everybody does it, and that includes Republicans. Sanders has responded by noting that he has given no paid speeches to Wall Street banks and thus has no such transcripts to release. So, Clinton's campaign continues to scramble, trying to shield her from the impression that she is too cozy with Wall Street while expecting that she will soon lock up the Democratic presidential nomination and make Sanders's criticism moot. The backlash Clinton has received over the three Goldman Sachs speeches and her ties to Wall Street has, however, forced Clinton to confront an issue which has dogged her campaign from the outset, namely, that she is an establishment candidate with close personal and political ties to Wall Street and big business, which compromises her objectivity and accountability as a candidate for the people, rather than for the corporations. During a debate in New Hampshire, Clinton claimed Sanders' innuendo amounted to a very artful smear. Clinton's press secretary Brian Fallon called it character assassination by insinuation, by implying that Clinton would not be tough on Wall Street because she has financially benefited from them in the past. So far, Clinton has responded to these criticisms rather unconvincingly. Under intense pressure to release the transcripts of the Goldman Sachs speeches, she has said she would look into it, though the Wall Street Journal has reported that Mrs. Clinton has the sole right to distribute the transcripts, with Politico asserting, "One thing that is clear is that Clinton could release the Goldman transcripts unilaterally if she chose to do so." Political damage. The real danger in releasing the transcripts is the potential political fodder it would provide Clinton's opponents, who might seek to use the transcripts as proof that Clinton is in the pocket of, not only Goldman Sachs, but Wall Street as a whole. But the negative insinuations are already there, as Politico related in the story of an unnamed source who attended one of Clinton's Goldman Sachs speeches in Arizona. The source related the tone and content of Clinton's speech that day as a rah-rah speech, where Clinton came off sounding more like a Goldman Sachs managing director. Politico reported, "It was pretty glowing about us," one person who watched the event said. "It's so far from what she sounds like as a candidate now." The Wall Street Journal summarized the speeches as such: "She didn't often talk about the financial crisis, but when she did, she almost always struck an amicable tone," according to these people. In some cases, she thanked the audience for what they had done for the country, the people said. One attendee said the warmth with which Mrs. Clinton greeted guests bordered on gushy. "She spoke sympathetically about the financial industry," according to an attendee. Asked about the poisoned national mood toward Wall Street, Mrs. Clinton didn't single out bankers or any other group for causing the 2008 financial crisis. So far, Clinton seems to have judged that the damage from continuing to hide the transcripts is preferable to the backlash she might experience if she released them. According to Politico, the person who saw Clinton's Arizona remarks to Goldman said they thought there was no chance the campaign would ever release them. "It would bury her against Sanders," this person said. "It really makes her look like an ally of the firm." In that case, releasing the transcripts could serve a severe blow to her campaign. Sanders' campaign would waste no time capitalizing on the opportunity to call out Clinton as a friend of Wall Street. Republicans' candidates could jump on the attack train, too, although this would be a bit like the right holding up a mirror to itself, since every Republican candidate except Trump has been the beneficiary of Wall Street's financial generosity. And Trump is arguable. Although he may not receive direct donations from big banks and business, he is certainly an established member of that social circle, so there are questions to be raised of political influence. Whose side are you on? Regardless, as it becomes clear that this campaign is breaking down to establishment versus anti-establishment candidates, Clinton's ties to her Wall Street and Beltway insider past are harming her ability to cultivate broad support amongst a population of voters resentful of Wall Street's insidious influence over Washington. So what is Clinton saying about all this? Not much. And what she has said has not diminished suspicions that she would be soft on Wall Street, if elected. Besides vague promises to look into releasing her speech transcripts, Clinton has defended her acceptance of the speaking fees in even vaguer terms. Anderson Cooper pressed her at a town hall meeting in New Hampshire, asking, "But did you have to be paid $675,000 for three speeches to Goldman Sachs?" Clinton responded to hearty laughter from the crowd, "Well, I don't know. That's what they offered." She continued, saying she didn't feel the fees represent a conflict of interest since she came back to run for public office, because she had not yet committed to running. She said further, "Anybody who knows me, who thinks that they can influence me, name anything they've influenced me on, just name one thing. I'm out here every day saying, I'm gonna shut them down, I'm going after them, I'm going to jail them if they should be jailed, I'm going to break them up. I mean, they're not giving me very much money now, I can tell you that much. Fine with me. I'm proud to have 90% of my donations from small donors and 60%, the highest ever, from women, which I'm really, really proud of." Cooper pushed, "So, just to be clear, that's not something you regret, those three speeches?" "No, I don't, because I don't feel that I paid any price for it and I'm very clear about what I will do and they're on notice," Clinton asserted. Clinton has pushed back in other ways, too. For instance, during a New Hampshire debate, Clinton called out what she saw as hypocrisy from Sanders's campaign. Senator Sanders took about $200,000 from Wall Street firms. Not directly, but through the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee. There was nothing wrong with that. It hasn't changed his view. Well, it didn't change my view or my vote either. A flip-flop. But not everyone is buying it. In an often cited incident, Senator Elizabeth Warren, D. Massachusetts, described in 2004 how Hillary Clinton flip-flopped on a credit card company-sponsored bankruptcy bill under pressure as a New York senator. According to Warren, in the late 1990s, then-President Bill Clinton was pursuing signing into law a bankruptcy bill which had been presented to Congress and written by the credit card companies. President Clinton was eager to sign the bill, in order to further promote his free trade, neoliberal economic policies. However, after a meeting between Warren and then-First Lady Hillary Clinton, in which Warren explained how the bill would have disproportionately hurt single mothers, Hillary vowed, "Professor Warren, we've got to stop that awful bill." Indeed, Hillary returned to the White House and convinced the president to veto the bill as one of his last acts in office. But then, once Hillary became senator for New York, the bill was reintroduced to Congress and she voted in favor of it. Warren explains, "As Senator Clinton, the pressures are very different. It's a well-financed industry. A lot of people don't realize that the industry that gave the most money to Washington over the past few years was not the oil industry, was not pharmaceuticals, it was consumer credit products. Those are the people, the credit card companies, who have been giving money and they have influence. Hillary Clinton has taken money from the groups and more to the point, she worries about them as a constituency. And what about her claim that 90% of her donations come from small donors?" According to 24/7 Wall Street, which conducted an investigation into each candidate's net worth, while 69% of Sanders' campaign contributions have come from small individual donations, only 17% of Clinton's contributions have come from small individual donations. Another interesting development from this hubbub about Clinton's ties to Wall Street has to do with whom Clinton would appoint as Treasury Secretary, if elected. Sanders's reference during the January 17th debate to the two Goldman Sachs executives who became Treasury secretaries may have spurred Clinton to address the issue. At that debate, Sanders said, "Goldman Sachs, paying a $5 billion fine, gives this country in recent history a Republican Secretary of Treasury, a Democratic Secretary of Treasury." Sanders's comment referenced the appointment of Robert Rubin, former Goldman Sachs executive, to the position of Treasury Secretary by Bill Clinton after Rubin opened doors to Wall Street donors during Clinton's first presidential bid. Rubin was instrumental in crafting an economic policy known as Rubinomics that was applauded by Wall Street but viewed critically by many on the left. When then First Lady Hillary Clinton decided to run for the Senate in New York in 2000, she turned to Rubin and Altman to introduce her to key players on Wall Street, reported the Washington Post. Who to name? Hillary Clinton addressed the Treasury Secretary issue on Meet the Press, saying, "You have to have a Treasury Secretary who understands the economy. I think there are a lot more places where one can and should look for such a Treasury Secretary." If Clinton were to make a clear promise not to appoint someone from Wall Street as Treasury Secretary, she could quell some voters' fears. But to be sure, this was not such a promise. The Treasury Secretary issue may also have been identified by the Clinton campaign as an opportunity to strike back at Sanders for what Clinton perceives as his political naivety. Bloomberg News reported, on the show, Clinton said Sanders has been less aggressive than she in pursuing abuses in the financial industry, adding that her rival's critique of the banking system and its role in the economy is simplistic. But there is another issue regarding paid speeches that has yet to be fully addressed by the media, which may prove to be a further thorn in Hillary's side. That is the question of Bill Clinton and the two-for-one aspect of the Clintons' political machine. An article by the Wall Street Journal relates how Hillary Clinton, while Secretary of State in 2009, helped Swiss bank UBS with its IRS woes. Total donations by UBS to the Clinton Foundation grew from less than $60,000 through 2008 to a cumulative total of about $600,000 by the end of 2014, according to the foundation and the bank. The bank also joined the Clinton Foundation to launch entrepreneurship and inner-city loan programs, through which it lent $32 million. And it paid former President Bill Clinton $1.5 million to participate in a series of question-and-answer sessions with UBS Wealth Management Chief Executive Bob McCann, making UBS his biggest single corporate source of speech income disclosed since he left the White House. While this still does not prove a direct link between favors by Hillary and payments received, it further blurs the line of where the Clintons' political activities stop and their personal ventures start. Earlier in the campaign, I wrote an article analyzing the sum of Hillary's paid speeches during the 14-month interim between Clinton leaving the State Department and before announcing her candidacy for president. That interim spanned January 2014 through March 2015, and resulted in Hillary making 53 paid speeches to the tune of $11.8 million in fees, all while it was widely believed that Clinton would run again for president in 2016. That analysis, however, did not include the $675,000 from Goldman Sachs, as those speeches were delivered in 2013, meaning they occurred before the time period for which she was obligated to publicly disclose her income. Bill Clinton's speeches. Further investigation of Hillary Clinton's financial disclosure form shows at least 16 speeches made by Bill Clinton to banks or other financial service industry companies during that 14-month period. Besides three speeches to USB Wealth Management totaling $675,000, the same amount Hillary received for her Goldman speeches, by the way, Bill also gave paid speeches to Bank of America, $500,000, SCIP Capital Management, $250,000, Deutsche Bank AG, $270,000 plus $280,000 to Hillary for her October 7, 2014 speech, Veritas Capital Fund Management, $250,000, Apollo Management Holdings, $250,000, Texas China Business Council, $265,000, Affiliated Managers Group, $225,000, Experian, $225,000, Insurance Accounting and Systems Association, $225,000, Centerview Partners, $225,000, Jefferies, $225,000, Citadel, $250,000, and Thomas Lloyd Global Assets Management, Schweitz, $200,000 via satellite. That means that Bill Clinton was paid $4,035,000 by the financial sector for 16 appearances over the course of 14 months. Keep in mind, those 14 months represent the interregnum between when Hillary Clinton left State Department and before she officially announced her candidacy, but it was widely speculated she would run. Regardless of whether Hillary believes, or will admit, that her fees from the financial industry have influenced her policies or not, the fact that campaign finance law requires her to disclose her spouse's income should be a guiding indication of what the rest of us already know, that payments made to one's spouse or close family members can equally represent a conflict of interest, just as if the candidate had been paid directly. An incisive article by Walter Russell Mead explains how the Clintons have worked this system to build the first postmodern political machine. The Clintons stand where money, influence, and celebrity form a nexus. When Hillary Clinton was running the State Department and Bill Clinton was shaking down contributors to the foundation, the donors knew, or thought they knew, what they were getting. Now that Hillary is running for president, the donors have an even better idea of what good things might come to them or what problems and complications could develop if they cut the Clintons off. Mead calls it honest graft, quoting Tammany Hall's George Washington Plunkett. The cash comes from donations and speaking fees. When the husband of the Secretary of State or potential next president calls about a special charity project, most people, even if they happen to be CEOs of major companies or senior government officials, take the call. More than that, there will be times when government and corporate officials will reach out and make the call themselves, rather than waiting passively to hear that the Clinton machine has an ask. The donor proposition is rock solid. What donors buy, or think they are buying, is influence and face time with two of the most powerful people in the world and their political machine. One parting thought, Goldman Sachs CEO Lloyd Blankfein, from the same Goldman Sachs who paid Hillary $675,000 for three speeches and produced Bill Clinton's Treasury Secretary, has said Bernie Sanders' critique of Wall Street has the potential to be a dangerous moment, not just for Wall Street, not just for the people who are particularly targeted, but for anybody who is a little bit out of line.
Well, there you go. The latest expose on the Clinton crime family. Not to be misconstrued with the Bush crime family or the Cheney crime family or all the other crime families. This is the Clinton crime family. And that's it for today. I'll be back with you tomorrow with more good stuff. Yeah. Stay off the chat boards. Tune in to my show and you'll get more down-to-earth stuff. Yeah. Bye-bye. Five words.
A bowl of cherries. Don't take it serious. Life's too mysterious. You work, you slave, you worry so, but you can't take your dough when you go, go, go. Keep repeating, it's the berry. The strongest oak must fall. The best things in life to you. Just long, so how can you lose what you never own? Life is just a bowl of cherries, so live and laugh at it all. Keep repeating, it's the berry. What you need.